Happy Wednesday, beautiful people. No Jordan Schusterman on today's episode of Baseball Barbercast, but I, Jake Mintz, will be joined by two special guests, Russell Dorsey of Yahoo Sports and Bailey Freeman of Foolish Baseball. We will talk to Russ about MLB's recent integration of the Negro Leagues into the MLB record books, and then we will talk to Bailey about just the whole lot of nothing. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world cooler than Papa Bell. I'm Jake Mintz, and that is Russell Dorsey. Jordan Schusterman is not here today because he is currently moving from Indiana to Cleveland. And instead, Russ of Yahoo Sports is pinch hitting and is here today to talk about the big news with the Negro Leagues being officially integrated into the MLB historical record. We will get to that in one moment. First, Russ, how are you?
Hey, buddy. I'm doing pretty well. It's been a wild 24 hours, as you probably can imagine. When you have a text from your mom when you wake up that you were on Good Morning America, something happened, right? Fortunately, it was something good that happened. But no, man, I'm good. Been seeing some good baseball as well.
Have you recovered from all of Milwaukee booing you when you showed up at American Family Field yesterday?
Yeah.
It was you, not Craig Counsell.
Yeah, it was me. It was me all the way. And look, that happens. And it's when people expect greatness, sometimes it doesn't always come in positivity. So, you know, we just take it in stride.
You don't have to tell me that. I just get negativity without the greatness. Speaking of greatness, let's talk about the story you wrote yesterday up at Yahoo Sports. A lot of original information in here. Russ, the Negro Leagues have been officially integrated into the MLB historical record. We first caught wind of this news a couple years ago. MLB announced that it was going to be starting this process. This news today represents the end of that process. So could you do me a favor and explain to me and to all the listeners what exactly was announced this week?
Yeah, well, today, actually day of this recording, MLB will be announcing that Negro League stats will officially be integrated into the MLB historical record, meaning that stats from over 2,300 players who played in Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948 in the seven different iterations of the Negro Leagues, those stats will now be officially included in MLB databases. So this means that what I reported yesterday, that Josh Gibson becomes the MLB single season leader or record holder in batting average, slug, and OPS. He's also the career leader in all three categories. It's huge news, right? Because baseball is a sport that has been around for a long time that doesn't come with a lot of changes when it comes to stuff like this. And I think one of the questions that I tried to answer in the story is, well, what does this mean? How does this happen? And something that you and I have talked about briefly of, well, how do you all of a sudden say these numbers are now major league records? Well, there was a committee in 1969, a special committee in 1969 that went through, looked at the history of Major League Baseball and said that what had become at the time and now the National League, the American League, the Players League, the Federal League, and the American Association would all be considered major leagues, meaning that the numbers, the records and statistics from all of those seasons, whether it was the Federal League, the Players League, the American Association,
all these old timey,
when you see Larry O'Houlihan who hit 495 right. for the Cleveland Spiders, those records counted towards MLB record books. And so for the people that were like, how can Josh Gibson lead? This wasn't Major League Baseball. Well, neither was Hugh Duffy. And people ask, who was Hugh Duffy? Hugh Duffy was the single season leader in batting average up until yesterday. Hit 440 in 1894 and was playing in, he played in the National League for both Chicago franchises at the time. He played in the American Association, the Players Association, or the Players Association. So like, he could also be considered somebody who never played Major League Baseball or played in both Major League Baseball and the league of his time? Does that not count? Well, it does, because he was already, and him and others are already in the leaderboards in Major League Baseball. So all that was happening. Then you get the question of how do you quantify these numbers, right? Because as many people know,
we're like, what matters and what doesn't, right? Like what counts?
I think when you look at Negro League seasons that were usually between 60 and 80 games, and then they would have like another 60 to 80 games of exhibitions or what's been known as barnstorming, right? Where if you look on Josh Gibson's plaque at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, it says he hit nearly 800 home runs, right? Now, the cool part about the Negro Leagues is that the oral history of them is really makes them stand out and makes players like Josh Gibson larger than life. And then we have the box scores and the information and data and clippings from old newspapers to like bring those even more to life, where it's like, oh, this isn't just some mythical figure. This was a real dude. Obviously pictures, et cetera. That was like a man amongst boys. But those records, when talking to John Thorne, who is Major League Baseball's official historian and also the chair of the Negro League Statistical Review Committee, he said, we couldn't take anecdotal evidence and use that for this. Like, we needed box scores, we needed data information that was had. Obviously, it's hard to get some of that information because some of it's been lost, some of it hasn't been recovered yet. And he did acknowledge that as more information turns up, more data is found, more box scores are found, they will continue to update and adjust. But he said they used data that was from what they considered league play. So those 60 to 80 games of official Negro Leagues games. And that is what is included now in the MLB database.
Got it. Couple different things come to mind. First is, I got bad news for racists out there. And that is that two black guys already broke. Yeah, I'm sure they are. Two black guys actually already broke Babe Ruth's record for home runs. So that ship has sailed. And so you can keep all that vitriol in your pocket, please. I have to say, I have a couple questions that come to mind, and I am confused about a number of things. And, you know, I know that you did not sit on the MLB committee that decided to do this, but you reported it. And so hopefully you can help me kind of parse through something.
Yeah.
The idea of a major league versus Major League Baseball is something that I don't totally understand, right? So I would say that Major League Baseball, the organization, as we think of it, is the American League and it is the National League. And those two leagues, since 1903, I believe, that is Major League Baseball. The Federal League, which came up in the 1914, 15, 16, around that time, that was never officially integrated into Major League Baseball, but it is still considered a major league, right? And so I'm struggling through the terminology here, because like Josh Gibson never played in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. So how can he be the all-time leader in a category in the Major League Baseball rule book? It almost feels to me like we need a separate like terminology here to simplify what we're talking about.
So let's go back to the 1969 review committee that they had, when they decided that National League, American League, and the Federal League, the Players League, American Association would all be considered or given major league status. When that happened, in accordance to those rules, they said that no asterisk or special category would be given to those leagues, which is why Hugh Duffy's 440 batting average for the Boston Reds stood for years. Ever. Including since 1969, as the single season leader in batting average in Major League history. Because of that ruling, the Negro League Statistical Review Committee, and I imagine that comes out later today when it's officially announced, is that they stood by that no asterisk, no special category or separation should be given to the Negro Leagues if that same thing wasn't included for the other leagues that were given major league status in 1969. They felt like it wouldn't be right to do it for the Negro Leagues and not do it for those other leagues that had been given major league status in 1969.
Got it. That makes more sense to me. My next question is very vague. What you wrote and reported yesterday was very informative. However, you did not share your opinion in this because you are
a reporter. Not a, Jake Mintz.
You're a reporter. And in this context, you are not a columnist, but no. I would like your opinion on it.
Okay.
You know, the very vague, big picture question is this good? Now, it is obviously much more complicated than that, right? I remember when this news first came out, Jordan and I had our mutual friend and friend of the program, Clinton Yates, on to talk about it. And at the time, Clinton was very off-put by the idea that the Negro League somehow needed Major League Baseball to recognize it in order to gain legitimacy. That the existence of the Negro Leagues was only made necessary because Major League Baseball did not let black players play until Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. Right. And so why is MLB the all-powerful deciding body here that, you know, created the problem in the first place, right? But on the flip side, I would imagine that any type of assistance or acknowledgement or from Major League Baseball allows the Negro Leagues to be understood and by a larger audience of people, right? So there are kind of two sides of the conversation. I'm curious where you land on it.
You know, when reporting something like this out, you don't really allow yourself time to give your, what do I think about this? You know, you have passing thoughts of, huh, that's interesting, or, oh, I never thought of it this way. So in you asking me this, and I had the benefit of you telling me that you were going to ask me this before we jumped on, I feel like baseball is a sport where history is really important. I also feel like when you try to tell the story of baseball, and I don't mean Major League Baseball, I mean the history of the game of baseball. If you try to tell that without telling the story of the Negro Leagues as well, you paint an incomplete picture.
Correct.
What I feel has happened in the last 24 hours is that you're starting to see a, and I mentioned this in the video that you see in my story, a more complete and broad picture of the history of major, or the history of baseball. And by Major League Baseball saying that we're going to, because I feel like this is what they feel like. I don't think they're trying to say, oh, yeah, they need us. I think they feel like they're trying to right a wrong where they do feel like Negro League should have been included in that 1969 review by that committee that included literally every other league that existed as having Major League status. But the Negro Leagues weren't included in that. It is the righting of a wrong. And do I feel like this is the right thing? I do, in the sense of you have to be able to tell full stories in history. This isn't saying that the black players weren't allowed to play in Major League Baseball, because they weren't. This isn't saying that the Negro Leagues is a lesser league. This isn't saying that the Negro Leagues needs Major League Baseball. But I think this is Major League Baseball acknowledging, like, no, this is something that should have happened a long time ago. And I think this is the Russell Dorsey side of it. I like the fact that you're always going to have new baseball fans. There are kids born every day in this world that are going to grow up loving baseball. And I talked to Bob Kendrick yesterday, and he said that part of what makes this big for him is that you have younger fans that are learning about the Negro Leagues for the first time. And he mentioned the inclusion in of the Negro Leagues in MLB The Show. And he said, what we are seeing is that you have the Negro Leagues now becoming part of a mainstream voice. It's been given a mainstream voice. And what he feels they are finding is that not only are young fans learning about the Negro Leagues, there's this growing love for the Negro Leagues. And he said that's all they've wanted since the beginning, with him being one of the biggest advocates for the Negro Leagues, president of the Negro Leagues Museum. in Kansas City. So I think that's the important part for me. And when I think, is this a good or bad thing? Because I had a lot of people hit me yesterday, like, oh, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? I think it's a good thing from the standpoint of telling a complete history is always going to be the right thing.
Well, you're going to have people go to leaderboards and they're going to see, you know, Josh Gibson, Mule Suttles, and they're going to say, what is it? Who is that? Right. And then they're going to go on Google or YouTube and look things up and learn. And I think that you're right. That is a positive development. And I think the idea that what really interests me about the Negro Leagues is the balance between myth and fact. And so much of what makes the Negro Leagues very special and beautiful is the myth of it, is the mystery of the feats that these guys were accomplishing. But the only reason that that mystery and that myth has to exist like that in the first place is because these guys weren't playing on TV or on the radio to the same extent and didn't have the same level of bookkeeping or stat keeping that, you know, Major League Baseball did, because they had less money to play with and less institutional organization because of racism and segregation in America. But at the same time, like, having all these facts now in some ways chips away at the myth that we have built up about some of these players. But I think what I found most beautiful about what came out is that it reinforces some of the myth, dude. Like, we had this idea that, you know, Josh Gibson was one of the greatest players of all time. Well, guess what? Numbers back that up.
I'm with you. And I think you look at a picture of Josh Gibson and he has massive forearms. He looks like a man child. Like, you hear 800 home runs and then you see him, you're like, ah, yeah, that tracks. Like, that makes sense. But no, I think and this was something talking to our good friend Clinton Yates, who's getting a lot of love in this podcast. Yesterday, he said one of the cool parts is the journalism that had to happen for this to even be a thing. Like, you're talking about decades and decades of research, people who've made it their lives work to find out as much as they can about the Negro Leagues and all that information.
But it's not
coming
just that.
Together.
It's not just the research that's being done. Obviously, that's really important and a big part of this. But it's all the people who are doing really important advocacy over the years to hold MLB's feet to the fire and say, this is something that you need to do, that should be done, that deserves to be done, right? And I think that there are people who are doing important journalism that if they had not done that, this would not have happened for another couple of decades even.
For sure. But I'm saying that, like, advocacy for this to happen without the people going and finding the data to even have and say, hey, this is the information that should be in the database is super important. Like, you're talking about things that go back over 100 years that had to be found and dug up, because there's only about the record, or the Negro League statistics are about 75% complete. That means that there's another 25% out there that hasn't been found yet. Some might never be found. Who knows? But I think the fact that 75% of the data has been found, it's a really big deal. And I think there are a lot of people who will sit back today and say, man, we did a lot of good work everybody knows Cool Papa Bell, right? People know Josh Gibson. People know Satchel Paige. But there are several Negro League legends who may have not have gotten their day, right? Now they get their day, where people are going to learn about them in various ways over the years now.
Here's an example. There's a guy named Charlie Chino Smith who hit .451 for the 1929 New York Lincoln Giants. I don't know anything about that guy. And when we're done, I'm going to, right here in 2 seconds, I'm going to open up his Wikipedia page and I'm going to read a bunch of stuff about him. And that is, at the end of the day, kind of the whole point, right?
And you want to know something, Jake Mintz, and for everybody out there, you want to know who he is? He is now number 2 all time on major league leaderboards in batting average behind Josh Gibson. There you go.
There you go. Russell Dorsey, thank you so much for joining us. Anything else you'd like to plug or say before we let you go?
No, I am tired, sir. I don't have the plugging ability today. I'm just kidding. Russ underscore Dorsey one on X or Twitter. Russ Dorsey on IG. You can also see me on MLB Network.
Or at the nicest hotel in your local city. I am Jake. After the break, we will welcome on friend of the show, Foolish Bailey, Foolish Baseball, who will take us to the ninth inning. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Vince here with the one and the only Bailey Freeman. You may know him as Foolish Baseball. You may know him as Foolish Bailey. You may even know him as the third best baseball YouTuber 4 years ago or the fourth best baseball YouTuber 3 years ago. Bailey, hello and welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jake. Thanks for having me.
Who is definitively better than you on baseball YouTube 3 years ago?
3 years ago, I would say Jimmy, John Boy. They have a whole media company. Yeah. I visited their office. I would say they're doing it better than I am, just in terms of sheer scale, if anything. Baseball Doesn't Exist has become sort of the supreme baseball video essay channel. Very happy for them. I've got to name one more that's better than me.
No, you're good.
Okay,
you're
now good. I'm good.
You could just tip your cap and move forward. I like asking broadcasters this question. That when I meet them, who is definitively better than you? Who do you believe is better than you? And it gives you a sense for who broadcasters like. And I guess I should start doing the same thing with writers, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. We are going to talk a little bit about umpiring because we got news, not who dropped it. It was a Nightingale bomb on Monday afternoon that Angel Hernandez has gone to the umpire school in the sky. He is with the other Angels now. He is not dead, but he has simply retired. The league's most famous or infamous umpire has called it a career after 33 years of calling balls, strikes, safes, and outs in the sport's highest league. So let me ask you, Bailey, what was your, when you saw this news, okay, Angel Hernandez, the much maligned poster child of bad officiating, what was your first reaction?
I was sad. I was saddened by this news. I think most people were celebrating. They were dancing in the streets. They said, oh, our national nightmare is over. Angel Hernandez is gone from officiating Major League Baseball games. I was sad. I was sad because of the timing, first and foremost. Like, I don't want to speculate or anything like that, but it's weird to have to retire in the middle of the season versus if he, you know, was announcing, yeah, hey, this is my one last ride and I'll be done after, the 2024 season. So that made me sad that he, you know, that this decision was somewhat involuntary one way or another, or he had other priorities that needed tending to. But I was saddened because a guy who everybody knows is going away. And, you know, I think that's the same for, you know, if a player goes on a retirement tour and maybe they weren't your favorite player, maybe they played for a team you didn't like, but you're still going to miss them because you're missing a memorable face from the game of baseball. And we're going to miss Angel Hernandez in that weird way, even though he was, I would say, largely an unpopular character.
So let's zoom out and try to summarize Angel Hernandez, the character, because I'm sure some people listening know the name, but don't know the game, okay? Because Angel Hernandez was, in many ways, one of a kind. So he rose to prominence as the bad umpire, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years, and it really elevated once Joe West retired. A couple of years ago, Joe West had been the longest tenured umpire. He had been the recipient of so much scrutiny as a mediocre umpire. And what made Hernandez a good punching bag for people, there were a couple of things. One, he was bad. He was bad at the job. He was below average at the job, both calling balls and strikes and elsewhere. He is distinctive looking, right? When he takes off his mask, he's got a, and I mean this nicely, he's got a big face, right? And I say this as someone with a big face. You, I would say, Bailey, have a little face, but Angel's got just a big old face. And so when you see his big old face, You're like, that's Angel Hernandez, right? And then the third thing is that he was about the lifestyle, okay? He loved umping, and he was around. He was embroiled in bizarre events and interactions, and he was a character in our world. Now, was he actually that bad? Yes and no. The stats say that he was 96th out of 132 umps in the StatCast era, according to ump scorecards accuracy metric for calling balls and strikes behind the plate. Bailey, can you give a little bit of context, just like how bad that is, 96th out of 132?
Yeah, I mean, it's... So I would say, just as a general trend in baseball umpiring, umpires have gotten better at aping or mimicking the StatCast strike zone. Before that, it would have been, you know, PitchFX. Before that, it was Questech, which was the software used to monitor umpire performance. But things have generally trended better. And the trend is older umpires are a little more creative. They're more willing to paint outside of the box. And the newer umpires are like very strict rulebook StatCast, you know, get it right in that regard. So for him to be 96th, honestly, if you were to adjust it for the fact that he umpired for 33 years, he would actually probably be a lot better than many of his peers in terms of, you know, umpires who came to prominence, you know, in the 90s, for example. So yeah, it's but, you know, 96 out of 132, I mean, as you put it, that is still below average. And that means you're probably getting the call right on a ball strike decision about 90-ish percent of the time. And the top tier guys are going to be closer to 95.
Right. So over the course of a game, that's two calls, right? Which what you wouldn't think that would kind of gnaw at you over time, but Angel has had some very famous misses. He had a game earlier this year. I think it was the furthest outside the zone called strike three in the StatCast era on a slider to Wyatt Langford, rookie for the Texas Rangers, from JP France, pitcher for the Houston Astros. That call is crazy. Go back and watch that one. It's nuts. But then, yeah, I mean, he just has so many big misses. There was his final regular season ejection was the Kyle Schwarber one on Sunday Night Baseball back in 2022, where Schwarber had the very famous rant where he was like pointing, outside you missed, inside you missed, up you missed, and down you missed. That was his final regular season heave-ho. His final ejection total, he threw out Lance Lynn and Ollie Marmol in spring training this year. And to have the chutzpah, the gumption to toss somebody in spring training is its own very bizarre, unique thing. And do you remember this whole thing, Bailey, where he threw out Lance Lynn and then Lance Lynn went to the bullpen to finish his pitches because he had to throw, and Angel wouldn't resume the game until Lance left the bullpen.
Yeah, and that's, I think it goes back to what you said about he loved being the umpire. He loved playing the role of the bad guy in many ways. And that is a good example. Even in spring training, you know, he's saying, this is my house.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I tweeted the picture the other day of his license plate on his car literally says, you're out. Okay? That's how much this dude was about the lifestyle. And I think as fans, as baseball watchers, we want the opposite, right? We have taught ourselves to believe that umpires should be like wallpaper. They are not characters. They are people whose names we should not know. Notoriety and infamy is not ideal for them. I think you and I disagree with that. I don't want my umpires to be bad, but I want them to lift the game up. I want them to elevate the game. I want them to be involved in it. If someone is going to stand on a Major League Baseball diamond, I don't want them to be an appendage. I want them to be a participant.
Yeah, I don't want them to be mannequins, you know? I want them to have definable features, some good, some bad.
And I think the last thing to just bring up with Angel is he sues MLB. Right. So he sues MLB for discrimination. And the basis of his suit was, I have been around for so long and you have not promoted me. The way that MLB umpiring crews work is there is a crew chief, right? Crew chiefs make more money. They are more likely to be selected for playoff assignments, and those have bonuses attached to them. And so one would think that umpiring in the majors for 30 years would have earned Angel some more opportunities in a crew chief position. That was not the case. He believed that there was discrimination involved. In the response to the suit, and this is kind of the most damning moment for Angel, in the response to the suit, MLB essentially goes, "We were not being racist. You just kind of suck at this job." And I believe the exact quote, let me pull it up, "unsuitable to serve in a permanent leadership role, an umpire in MLB's highest profile games," right? And that is truly sad to have your boss, the organization, say to you, "Nope, it has had nothing to do with you being named Angel Hernandez. It had everything to do with you being bad at calling balls and strikes." But I do think it raises an interesting question, right? Like, what is it, 30%-ish, 28% of players in the big leagues have Spanish as a first language? And the number of umpires who speak Spanish is significantly lower than that. And Angel Hernandez's role as a Spanish-speaking Latino, Cuban-born umpire, right? That is important. That is important in our sport to make sure there is a fairer playing field. He just so happened to be bad at the job.
Yeah, and that's kind of the issue, right? It's probably he had a correct message in doing so. Like, it is very possible that, you know, there need to be more Spanish-speaking umpires in the ranks or in leadership positions like crew chief or getting, you know, assignments in postseason and all-star games. He just was not the person to deliver this message necessarily, and it kind of backfired and ultimately added to his reputation.
Right. And then I highly recommend everybody go read an article, I'll tweet it out later, that was in the Miami Herald in 1993 when Angel Hernandez went to umpire his first game in Miami, the city he grew up in. And it goes into Angel Hernandez's love of umping from a young age. He liked playing baseball, but he would leave his Little League games, change into the umpire outfit in the restroom, and then go call balls and strikes. And that is so, like, he became the villain, man. He became the villain he never wanted to be. It was a role that was deserved, a role that was earned. But at the beginning, all this guy wanted to do was call balls and strikes.
He reminds me of Nicholas Angel, the character in Hot Fuzz, the main character, tells the origin story of him driving his little like tricycle and arresting people, and then he grows up to be a cop. That's basically what Angel Hernandez did. He grew up to be the baseball cop, and that's what he wanted to be all along.
We say this in the show all the time, umps are cops. But with Angel at the door, it leaves a void. It leaves a position that needs to be filled. He was the true punching bag. He was the poster child for bad umping. If I asked any baseball casual who is the worst umpire, many of them would say Angel Hernandez. And so we will have a brief conversation now about who will take that mantle. Bailey, what makes a famous bad umpire, though?
They have to know your name. That's what it is. And it's not just baseball sickos, because baseball sickos know who Pat Hoberg is. Pat Hoberg, he of the very accurate strike zone, perfect Pat in the World Series. I have to be able to go to the bar and find someone mad at you. You know, like, if I go into the bar and I say Angel Hernandez, they'd be like, "Ah, he sucks," you know? And I live near five bars, so I'm sure I can find at least one person that would say, "Ah, he
sucks."
Right,
but if you went to the bar and you were like, "Doug Eddings."
They don't care about Doug Eddings. Doug Eddings, no juice with these people. So there's two that came to mind for me when I posed this question. Well, actually, the first one that came to mind was C.B. Buckner. He has you need tenure and you need name recognition. And for me, he kind of becomes the next guy. I guess also like Laz Diaz was the second one. But even I would say CB for me came up first just in my special mind palace. So what about you? What do you think about those nominations?
Yeah, I think CB is both bad at calling balls and strikes, and he has a distinct look. I mean, he's bald. I think that the problem with CB, though, is he doesn't do enough weird stuff, right? Angel would do weird stuff where he would over-ump. CB doesn't really do that. And I don't think, I think you are right that just because his name is two letters that are not often grouped together in a name, right? Like J.A. Adonde, you remember, because not a lot of J.A.'s. You know, and I think that CB does have that going for him. The other names that came to mind for me, Jim Wolf, who is absolutely ripped, We have, who's the NFL official who's ripped and Hockley. Became famous because he was ripped?
Ed Hockley.
Yes. Yes. I think Jim Wolf could get his way to notoriety through a similar lane. Hunter Wendelstadt, I will say, when you talk to players, is the name that comes up for who stinks at the job. So when I asked around yesterday about about Angel Hernandez, two different players were like, yeah, he was bad, but not nearly as bad as Hunter Wendelstadt. Wendelstadt was the up who threw out Aaron Boone earlier this year when the fan yelled at him and not Aaron. Hunter Wendelstadt, whose dad is the namesake for the Harry Wendelstadt umpiring school in Florida that a lot of big league umpires go through. Hunter is pretty much accepted within the game as Buns. And then Phil Cuzzy has a very distinct energy. He's got like the New Jersey Italian Sopranos. He's got the wet hair. He often sticks his arms underneath his pits to rest them, which is like a very unique kind of look. Oh, and then the last one is Junior Valentine, who has burst onto the scene recently with some totally bizarre officiating decisions, most notably the infield fly that happened. Infield fly, not obstruction. What did they call it? Runner in Chicago where the runner bumped into Gunnar Henderson, right? That was his call. He seems like someone who loves to umpire. He has a distinct name. He has a distinct look. He is young. His problem, though, Bailey, is that he's not terrible at calling balls and strikes. He's actually about average.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that's part of what made Angel Hernandez special. It's that he wasn't the worst, you know, ball strike caller. He probably wasn't even the worst in terms of letting his ego get in the way of, you know, like trying to run the game and make the game about himself. But he just was good enough in all those areas and recognizable and distinct enough that he has a lasting legacy in the game of baseball that for many is negative. But I will miss him for sure.
So email us, baseball. Barbacast@gmail.com. If you think there's an ump we're missing, if there's someone who comes to the top of your mind as the next Angel Hernandez, please, please let us know. Let's move on to a couple dribs and drabs from around the traps. Craig Counsell back in Milwaukee this week. He was the skipper of the Brewers for, I believe, eight years, one of those two, before bolting to Chicago this past winter for a hefty contract to manage the rival Chicago Cubs. He was indeed booed in his return to AmFam, American Family Field. Bailey, when you saw Craig Counsell underneath a torrential downpour of jeers, what was your reaction?
I thought it was fine. I think we as, none of us grew up, you know, Cubs or Brewers fans here, but as neutral fans, I think we love, you know, getting a chance to judge a fan base based on their decision to boo or cheer a returning player or manager. We love to, sort of base their character off of that decision, or if it's a mix of cheers and jeers. This was mostly jeers. This was boos. And I guess what just makes it acceptable to me is that he left them for the division rival. He left them for the, you know, the big bad Cubs in the NL Central after, having some really nice years in Milwaukee, and they were in the playoffs last year, and they were generally in the playoffs with him more often than not. And that's kind of the point that I want to make, is if he'd have left them, you know, for the massive, you know, record-setting paycheck to join the Mets or the Angels or the Giants or any of the other teams with managerial openings, I don't think they would have booed him upon his return to Milwaukee. But he left for the Cubs. That was his decision. I understand why he did it. They're paying him way more money. And, the team is probably has more budget for free agent spending in the near future. So, I think totally fine for Craig Counsell to leave and totally fine for him to get booed when he returns to Milwaukee. It was all in good fun.
I think we boot up the multiple things can be true machine here, because that is the case, right? And I think, I don't know how you feel about booing, but Jordan and I are generally like very anti-boo. I think that you should only usually boo if there were crimes, right? If there were crimes done or PEDs ingested and proven to be the case. Usually I don't love a boo. However, this case is about as understandable as it gets. Remember, Craig Counsell is not just the manager of the Milwaukee Brewers. He was born and raised in Milwaukee. He went to high school in Milwaukee. He played for the Brewers. He was not just from there. He was of there. And I think that when you have a player or a manager who is from the place where the team plays, it only heightens that level of connection, because Brewers fans could look at Craig Counsell and be like, he's one of us, right? He went to Whitefish Bay High School. He probably goes to Eagle Park Brewery. He is from this place. He knows the place and fans like that. And for him to leave, it almost says, oh, none of that mattered, right? Hey, oh, all the things that we thought were important to Craig Counsell, none of that mattered. So feel free to boo. Totally chill. I have no issue with it. I hope these two teams go down to the wire. I kind of want them to tie for the division and have the one game playoff that they had back in 2018.
Well, can I say something, you know, just with regards to that division race? I think Brewers fans felt empowered to boo because they are currently leading in the standings. And so if the idea for Craig Counsell is I'm leaving for greener pastures, that has not necessarily been the case, at least for the first third of this season.
I think we generally believe that Craig Counsell is one of the best managers in baseball, if not the best manager in baseball. I would say that his decision-making and the record-breaking contract he got over the offseason both back that up. Does Milwaukee's early season success under Pat Murphy make you rethink the skill or the impact or the importance of Craig Counsell? That the team has continued to thrive and succeed in his absence, should that or does that lessen the way we think about him?
For me, ever so slightly, it does. And I think it's not necessarily... we're not necessarily auditing Craig Counsell here. We're auditing just the role of the manager in general in Major League Baseball in 2024. And, you know, the Brewers have a good organization. You know, they it's not just Counsell departed. It's, you know, Stearns departed too. So they had turnover both in terms of the field manager and general manager. And yet they continue to do well, at least so far through the first third of the season. The question I always pose people to try to, you know, help ascertain how they feel about manager value is, I'll say, hey, you know, if you could choose between having a replacement level manager and Shohei Ohtani versus, you know, Craig Counsell and not having Shohei Ohtani, obviously you would choose Ohtani. And I kind of tried to think of that in terms of WAR. Okay, Ohtani's like an 8-10 WAR player. Okay, would you rather have Craig Counsell or like a 3 WAR player? Would you rather have Craig Counsell or Ian Happ? And I think once you start to get down to brass tacks on that debate, you can kind of see where everyone is at in terms of how they value managers. But I think it does probably decrease how much I value Craig Counsell a little bit, given how successful Pat Murphy has been in the early goings with the Brewers. But at the same time, I don't think I valued managers that high in particular. And I think Craig Counsell is one of the best, if not the best, in the game.
I think as long as you're competent, it's fine. I think bad managers are bigger drags than good managers are helpful, right? I think you can really mess it up more than you can single-handedly do fix something, right?
Yeah, there's, I guess the concept would be unforced errors. Like, so for instance, sometimes we discuss lineup construction, how even if you rearrange the lineup totally random, as inefficiently as possible as you could, it's probably only going to make a difference between like maybe one or two wins in the entire year. But if you do lineup construction poorly, it's just an unforced error, right? And that's what having a drag of a manager is.
And the good teams just have the front office make the lineup anyway. Here's a theoretical manager question. Let's say the 2024 Cubs are a 90-win team. I think they're a little worse than that, but let's just say they're a 90-win team. If you took Craig Counsell out of that equation and you replaced him with Pep Guardiola, the manager of Manchester City Football Club, who is considered one of the best managers in the world, or you could use Jurgen Klopp, former manager at Liverpool, and you replaced Counsell with Klopp or Guardiola, you took away one of the best managers in baseball with a great manager of professional athletes who knows very little to absolutely nothing about the sport itself. What is the change in win total over the course of the season? Is it 15? Is it 5? Is it 0?
Yeah, you're pitching me the reverse Ted Lasso here a little bit. I think you're probably going to lose. Well, it depends on what role everyone else takes, right? If, like you said, if the front office is setting the lineup, if the bench coach is, you know, working the bullpen.
Your bench coach is still Ryan Flaherty.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Then the difference is maybe, I don't know, a couple wins. But, or actually, you know, here's an interesting one. What are the Cubs players thinking when you bring in Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp? They're saying, we're bringing in a guy who doesn't even know anything about baseball. Is that affecting their ability to play? But I'll continue to play along with the little game. I would say probably 3 to 4 wins. But I think that like manager value manifests itself differently year over year, because I think one manager, like the same manager, could be like a +7 guy 1 year and then like a -4 guy the next year through really no fault of his own, just depending on how he vibes with certain players on the roster and how certain decisions go. So as a general rule, between the replacement level European football manager and the actual baseball field manager, I would probably lean on like, you know, 3 to 4 wins being the difference.
Whereas you and I think it would be even worse. I think you and I would be worse MLB managers as people who know ball but can't manage.
Yeah. Like, I don't really know how to talk to baseball players, so I don't think I'd be able to do it. You have more experience talking to baseball players than I do, but even that would probably be difficult being in charge.
Yeah. They'd be like, you are an idiot. Like, I don't believe anything that you're going to say. Let's actually pivot now to a first-year manager, somebody who must be thinking that running a baseball team is much easier than it was made out to be, because the Cleveland Guardians and their first-year skipper, Stephen Vogt, are one of the hottest, best teams in baseball. Or are they? I guess that's what we'll talk about. Cleveland right now, on the morning of May 29th, sits at 37-18. The only team with a better record in the sport is the Philadelphia Phillies. That is it. They have a better record. The Cleveland Guardians right now have a better record than the New York Yankees, who it feels like they don't ever lose. What has made the Guardians so competitive so far this year, Bailey? And more important, what have you enjoyed about Cleveland to this point in the season?
So I would say, with regards to the Guardians, they always had a talented roster. Even last year when they scuffled, I feel like they've had ebbs and flows in terms of their wins and losses, but the talent on the roster has remained. And this year they are just finding a way to maximize that talent overall. And the team has been brilliant top to bottom. I do want to shout out David Fry, among all hitters, minimum 100 plate appearances. So he's not a qualified batsman, but he leads the league in OPS. His OPS is, I believe, after last night he homered, so a little over 1100, which is just... And look, as baseball people, as baseball prognosticators, I think when we predict how a season is going to go for a team, like, we're ready for a lot of variations. We're ready for a lot of players that could make a big impact on the season and who couldn't. David Fry was not on my radar as someone who was going to greatly impact the wins and losses of the Cleveland Guardians. And yet here we are. He's been, on a rate basis, the best hitter in baseball. What's fun with the Stephen Vogt thing for me is, if you just go around the league right now and you even ask fans, like, oh, what current player is going to be a good future manager? The default answer is going to be whoever is like a likable journeyman catcher. And that's exactly what Stephen Vogt was. And it's fun to see him just hop straight into the managerial ranks and do very well. As you said earlier, he must think it is really, really easy.
I want to give a shout out, though. Like, you're right. For so long, that was the path, right? Oh, you're a journeyman catcher. Well, you must be a manager. Shouts out to Eric Kratz for turning that hat backwards and for paving the way, okay? For foul territory, you are that's a trailblazing decision, right? Going where no backup catcher has gone before. You don't need to manage, okay? You don't even need to be a bullpen catcher or a bench coach. Media is there for you. So Garrett Stubbs, you don't have to manage. Come to us. Come to the dark side.
Talk into a microphone for a living instead.
Do it. You don't want that smoke. You don't want to be Pep Guardiola. Bailey, Jose Ramirez has been one of your favorite players for a long time. Let me ask this question first. Why?
Yes.
What about Jose Ramirez tickles your fancy?
He has
tickled your fancy.
He is a maximizer. God gave Jose Ramirez a body, and he did not give him the prototypical baseball body. But within that body, Jose Ramirez has become the best baseball player he could ever possibly be within that body year after year after year. I find it so admirable the way he is just, he has maximized it. He does not have the greatest raw pop. What does he do? He just pulls fly balls at a prodigious rate. So he's still going to hit 30 homers this season. He does not look like he's fast, but he runs fast. He'll steal bases. He plays really underrated defense at third base. But fundamentally, the reason I like Jose Ramirez is because he was given a body and he is the best baseball player he can possibly be in that body. And I don't think that's true for the vast majority of baseball players. They're great athletes, but they could always be a little bit better.
But it is true for you and I, you know, and I think that's why he's very relatable. We are probably the best baseball players we could have been in our given bodies. And so we look at Jose Ramirez and we say, that's me.
I've certainly made it as far in the baseball industry as I possibly could given my body.
Yeah, I would agree. I have the same situation. This season, Jose Ramirez is currently slashing 272, 328, 558. That is a 148 WRC plus. However, he was pretty mediocre to start the season and has been absolutely on fire in the month of May. I believe he has more home runs than strikeouts over like the last 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. But the crazy thing, when you look at his numbers, he's running a 244 BABIP. And so he has been remarkably unlucky on balls in play.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, the league average BABIP in any given year is usually around 300. And hitters can kind of fluctuate between a 250 to a 350 based on, you know, across a larger sample, I'll say. And so he may lean on being, you know, a 260, 270 true BABIP guy just because he hits so many fly balls, and fly balls have a lower BABIP when they are not. When they are not home runs, home runs are not balls in play. But yeah, I mean, a 244 BABIP, that kind of tells you where he's at right now. The split for me that is cracking me up is the difference between the runners on base and the runners not on base, which is especially relevant because he leads the league in runs batted in by a long shot right now. But I will say Jose Ramirez, with the bases empty this year, which thankfully hasn't even been all that often because Cleveland's lineup's been so good, 205 average, 271 on base, 348 slug. So a 600 OPS guy. With men on base, he has an OPS nearing 1,200. He has a 343 average, a 388 on base, and a 781 slug. 12 of his 16 home runs have come with men on base. And I don't think this is necessarily a repeatable skill to be that much better with men on base than with the bases empty. But it's just been fun to watch. And I think it just sort of shows that, you know, when things are right in Cleveland, things are really right. And Jose Ramirez is just generating everything for this offense, despite some really great bats around him.
For comparison, dude, David Fry has a 412 BABIP.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see that coming down.
You know. Yeah, that might dwindle over the next couple of weeks. Ramirez, though, so he is probably a future Hall of Famer. And still, he has never won an MVP. This feels like a pretty decent chance for him to win the MVP he wants. Is that something that you, as a Jose Ramirez stan, care about? Do you want to look back in 35 years and say, 2024, he got that on the mantle?
I do care. I think it's just a nice way to round out a baseball reference page. And I for Jose Ramirez in particular, and granted, this was a completely different beast of a season, I felt very strongly that Jose Ramirez should have won MVP in 2020. It was a shortened season, but I think if you compared what he did to Jose Abreu, he was as good offensively while contributing more in terms of the base running and defensive side of the game. And so in that sense, it would be a nice little bit of retribution for him to get that MVP in a full season that people ultimately remember more than, you know, whatever awards were given out in 2020.
And, you know, he's got 56 RBI right now in 54 games. And if there's one thing I know about MVP voting, it's that RBI, that is the way you secure.
He's well on the way. He's well on the way to winning like the 1999 MVP at this rate.
That's the thing, dude. Yeah. Like, it's so funny that a guy who, you know, I would say that Jose Ramirez's numbers would jump out in any era, but I think he probably his appreciation has been helped by our understanding of advanced metrics. The idea that he could just have an unbelievable RBI season is so funny. He only has three seasons over 100 RBI, which is typically the mark of a great player. Last year, he had only 80 RBI, which is feels remarkably low for a guy who hit 24 homers and had a 130 OPS plus.
Yeah, I mean, he has 56 right now. He's like two-thirds of the way to his total. Like, that's crazy.
Jose Ramirez, please win the MVP. All right, a couple quick things, and then we're going to get out of here. I wrote down on this document, what does Bailey want to talk about? What does Foolish Baseball, although I would say this is probably more Foolish Bailey.
Yeah.
Bailey, what do you want to talk about? What around the league is tickling your fancy?
Yeah, we got a few topics here. The first one, I do want to shout out my Atlanta Braves, who are going through a little bit of a tough time right now. But one guy who is not going through a tough time right now, Chris Sale. Chris Sale, here are his stats in May, or at least the ones that are relevant to me. He started 5 games in the month of May. He'll also start on June 1st. So if you want to, you know, throw that in there, we'll wait and see. 32 innings pitched. My favorite stat from this, 45 strikeouts to 2 walks in the month of May. That is quite the ratio he's got going there. And that leads to only 2 earned runs allowed the entire month, a 0.56 ERA in May. I imagine he will be the pitcher of the month for the National League when that comes. And I did do a little stat head. I don't know if you guys have a stat head code or not, but I have a stat head code. You can look it up. I'm not going to shout it out. No free ads. But I looked for relevant month splits, and I basically searched for who in a month has started 5 games and had an ERA under 1 and just that ridiculously good ratio in strikeouts to walks. I said 20, at least 20 strikeouts per walk. I said it's happened twice. May 2024, Chris Sale, I just mentioned, but the other two, Clayton Kershaw, May 2016. That's pretty good company. Those are the only two in the modern era. And then I want to shout out Adi Joss. He died young, but one of the great pitchers of the dead ball era. They actually waived the 10-year Hall of Fame thing for him because I think he only pitched in 9, but he had quite the May 1908 as well. So shout outs to Adi Joss and Clayton Kershaw. Not bad company to be in.
Hey, Bailey, the guy who Chris Sale was traded for, Vaughn Grissom, I always say Grissom for no reason. Vaughn Grissom, do you know what his OPS plus is right now for the Boston Red Sox?
I can't imagine it's high. I'm going to take just a total stab at it right now. I'm going to say his OPS plus is 55. It's 1. You're holding up 1 finger.
I am holding up a finger. I'm holding up 1 finger.
Yes.
Vaughn Grissom has an OPS plus of 1. Granted, he missed the first couple months of the year, or the first month of the year. He's only tallied 76 plate appearances. That is a number that is sure to rise. However, he has looked abysmal. He is hitting 141, 197, 155 for an OPS plus of 1, 1, 1, not 2. Yeah.
100 is average.
Meanwhile,
to be clear,
100 is average. 1 is not.
Yeah.
Chris Sale, Cy Young 2024. That being the year he finally wins his first Cy Young would be so nuts.
Yes, that would be, we had the Jose Ramirez conversation, but Chris Sale winning a Cy Young award after, because I think they do it, you know, there's like the concept of like Cy Young shares or Cy Young points, like, you know, just based on how he's received the voting. I think he is technically expected to have won at least like 1 or 2 by now. So if he just grabs a Cy Young this year, that would be very funny. And then I think that would definitely like change how we approach his like Hall of Fame discussion as well.
What's your panic level for the Braves right now?
Well, it's interesting. I think most Braves fans are somewhat relishing the fact that they no longer have to be like total like front runners. Like everyone knows they're the best. Everyone's gunning for them because they are having to do it without Strider and Acuna right now. And there is some comfort there because they did win the World Series without Acuna famously. And I'm sure AA will cook up a corner outfield trade. Here's my thing. I'm gonna be bullish because I think it's more fun that way. Like, because if you look at the Phillies roster right now, they have like a 6-game lead, I think. And they just have a better roster, as things stand. Yeah, no, I like the idea that the Braves could still win the division. I think that's like more fun than resigning ourselves to playing the role that the Phillies have played in the past few years, which is we're going to grab a wild card and then we're going to hopefully, you know, be giant killers in the playoffs. I would love to see the Braves just mentality still be we are the Giants and not, oh, these awful things have befallen us and we just have to settle for what is basically, you know, participating in the wild card race.
Are they the favorites now, the Phillies?
They have to be with the lead. And I mean, look, if... and I don't believe in any sort of Hammurabi-esque eye for an eye situation, but like if the Phillies lost Harper and Wheeler tomorrow, they wouldn't be, you know, then that's the Braves equivalent, you know, right, with Acuna and Strider. But I think just given the lead and given the what I believe is a better roster as constructed right now, better 26-man roster, yeah, I would say the Phillies are the favorites. But I don't want to admit that as a Braves fan because I like the idea that we could still be the favorites because that's more fun than doing the Phillies underdog thing that they've been doing.
I think the Braves being 31-21, 5 games out right now, without the best pitcher in the world, Spencer Strider, and with 2 months of a mediocre Ronald Acuna Jr. and now the rest of the season without him, that is a testament to the organization and what they've built and the sustainability of it and the roster top to bottom. I mean, if you look at the Braves' top four players by Baseball Reference WAR right now, it is Chris Sale, Marcell Ozuna, Reynaldo Lopez, and Travis d'Arnaud, right? I believe none of whom were all-stars last year, right? And the Braves had, what, 7 all-stars last year, okay? And so I think that is incredibly impressive and very notable. And I would say it's probably a coin flip now. I just think the Phillies have been so healthy and their schedule has been so easy and so fortunate so far this season that I think it's going to be closer at the end of the year than people believe. You make your living making baseball related videos on a website called YouTube. How many videos have you made under the Foolish Baseball channel in your life, in your career?
I think,
do you know the number?
I want to say total videos, I don't know, but I know for Baseball Bits, it's in the 70s. I'm going to say about 73, 74.
Okay. What is your least favorite that you've ever made?
Ooh, that's a good one. That's tough. My least favorite, I'm going to say, is the one I did about Pujols and his decline and his, I was particularly interested in his speed or lack thereof, particularly down the first baseline. The reason I didn't like this one is because I didn't feel like it was representative of what I want to do with the channel, which is mostly to build people up and to make people interested in baseball. And there's, if you look around like sports YouTube landscape in general, there's a lot of like this player fell off content. And I think I...
What happened to this
guy? What happened? The rise and fall. That's the number one thing. The rise and fall of name any guy who was good for like 2 seasons and then wasn't anymore.
And usually the fall is they got older.
The fall is they got older, they got hurt, you know, and that's it. So I felt like I was feeding into that in a way and that I didn't feel like was necessarily representative of what I wanted to do. Because even when I highlight negative aspects of players, like I try to spin it into a positive. And that Rod Barajas video is a good example, the one I just made reference to. Historically bad at throwing out base runners. Yet at the same time, that was not a priority for the Pirates as a whole. And many argue that, you know, you steal bases off the pitcher, not the catcher. So that I feel like is my least favorite video in the sense that it's not representative of what I try to do. Mm.
And then which one is the most mid?
Ooh, the most mid, as the kids say. The most mid one. That's a good question. I did one.
Not good, not bad. Yeah. Just middle of the
just
road.
Here's a classic middle of the road one I did a few years ago. I did one about it was the Twins Yankees 2019 regular season, the crazy back and forth game that ended in the Aaron Hicks catch. And I wanted to use that episode to just have one that's not so like sabermetric heavy and to sort of, you know, if someone were, interested in baseball for the first time, could I just tell the story of an interesting baseball game, you know, without leaning on all that stuff? And it is a perfectly fine, perfectly acceptable episode of what I do, but it is not the best and it is not the worst.
And then you mentioned this before, but the ones that you really love are highlighting things that people didn't know that enhance someone's understanding of the sport in a positive way. So what are some that come to mind right away?
Yeah, I like whenever...
Besides Rod Barajas.
I like whenever a player is identified with me in some weird way. So, Tim LaCastro for sure. This one is sort of relevant to the Angel Hernandez discussions we had earlier, but the one I did a couple years ago, which is called What Bad Umpiring Looks Like, and is just sort of an exploration of the history of the strike zone in Major League Baseball in general. That's one that I'm really proud of. I'm really proud of the one I did last year about Bill Duplessis, the replay coordinator for the Kansas City Royals and how, you know, that may actually have value and how I tried to actually quantify that value in terms of wins added or you know, wins subtracted. I really enjoyed those. I like highlighting the weird minutia. I mean, that's pretty clear what I do. It's just even from a cursory glance at my YouTube channel.
Well, Bailey, thank you for coming on and doing this podcast with me. It is genuinely appreciated. I will say that everything you do, everything you make, have made, tweet, have tweeted, enhances my appreciation for the sport of baseball and or makes me laugh. And that I feel like is the whole point of what we do, besides, you know, making a living.
Yeah.
That's important as well. Bailey, is there anything else you'd like to promote or plug before we say goodbye?
On my second channel, Foolish Bailey, I'm trying to rebuild the Oakland Athletics on Out of the Park Baseball. Come watch me flounder under the crushing constraints of a really tight John Fisher budget.
Mm. Woohoo! Bailey, thank you for joining us. Thank you to Russ Dorsey for joining us in the first half of the show. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to Jordan Schusterman for moving from Indiana to Cleveland and allowing me to have conversations with other people for a change. We will see everybody on Friday, where we will have another guest because Jordan won't be back. Who's that guest going to be? Your guess is as good as mine.